the Oracle's pythonesses. Less excusable was Apollo's treatment of a satyr named Marsyas. This happy fellow had the misfortune to be an excellent musician, a realm Apollo considered his own, and where he would brook no rivalry. Hearing the satyr praised too often, Apollo invited him to a contest. The winner was to choose a penalty to which the loser would have to submit, and the muses were to judge. So Marsyas played his flute, and Apollo played his lyre. They played exquisitely. The muses could not choose between them. Then Apollo shouted, "Now you must turn your instrument upside down and play and sing at the same time. That is the rule. I go first." Thereupon the god turned his lyre upside down and played and sang a hymn praising the gods, and especially their beautiful daughters, the muses. But you cannot play a flute upside down, and certainly cannot sing while playing it. So Marsyas was declared the loser. Apollo collected his price. He flayed Marsyas alive and nailed his skin to a tree. A stream gushed from the tree's roots and became a river. On the banks of that river grew reeds which sang softly when the wind blew. People called the river Marsyas, and that is still its name. Sons of Apollo. During the contest with the satyr Marsyas, Apollo won the favor of the most playful muse, Thalia, queen of festivities. Upon her he fathered the Corybantes, or crested dancers, lithe young men who shaved their hair to a forelock and danced at great rituals. Then, roaming the hillsides, he came across a young girl who reminded him of his sister. She was a huntress. She chased deer on foot, hunted bears and wolves. When he saw her wrestling a full-grown lion and throwing it to earth, he decided he must have her. Her name was Cyrene. The son he gave her was named Aristaeus, who taught man beekeeping, olive culture, cheese-making, and many other useful arts. His next adventure was with the nymph Dryope. He found her tending sheep on a mountainside. He hid behind a tree and watched her. To his dismay, she was joined by a gaggle of hamadryads, mischievous girls who love to tell tales. So he had to stay hidden. He waited for the hamadryads to leave, but they lingered. Gods are impatient. They hate to be kept waiting. He changed himself into a tortoise and crawled out. The nymphs were delighted to see him, and turned him this way and that, and tickled him with a straw. He was a splendid, glossy tortoise, with a beautiful black and green shell. Dryope wanted him for her own, and put him in her tunic. When her friends protested, he turned himself into a snake, poked his head out of the tunic, and hissed at them. The hamadryads fled, screaming. Dryope fainted. When she came to, she was in the arms of a god. Their son was Amphissus, founder of cities and builder of temples. But his most famous son was Asclepius. This was the manner of his birth. Apollo fell in love with Coronis, a princess of Thessaly, and insisted on having his way, which was unwise of him because she loved an Arcadian prince named Ischys. When she was with child, Apollo went on a journey, but set a white crow to spy on her. All crows were white then, and were excellent chaperones. They had sharp eyes and jeering voices. It was to Delphi that Apollo had gone. An oracle there told him that at that very moment Coronis was entertaining young Ischys. Just then the crow flew in, wildly excited, full of scandal, telling the same tale. "Your fault! You did not watch her closely enough!" cried Apollo. And he cursed the crow with a curse so furious that her feathers were scorched, and all crows have been black ever since. Apollo could not bring himself to kill Coronis, so he asked his sister Artemis to oblige him. She was happy to. She was never fond of his amours. She sped to Thessaly and finished Coronis with one arrow. Apollo, very dejected, put the corpse on the funeral pyre and lighted the fire. Then he remembered that she was with child by him. Hermes was now standing by, waiting to conduct her soul to Tartarus, for that was one of his duties. Understanding the situation in a flash, he delivered the dead girl of a living child, a boy. Apollo wished to have nothing to do with the child, and asked Hermes to take care of him. Hermes had been struck by the way the baby had observed the details of his own birth, watching everything with a wide stare. So interested, he forgot to cry, and recognized that this was an unusual child. So he gave him into the care of Chiron, the centaur, the fabulous tutor. Chiron taught him diagnostics, surgery, herbology, and hunting. The boy could not wait to grow up. He doctored everyone he could get his hands on, and was soon known throughout the land for his skill at curing the sick. His fame reached Apollo, who decided to test him. He appeared at Asclepius's door in the guise of a feeble old man, afflicted with every loathsome disease known to medicine, and a pauper besides. Asclepius tended him with his own hands, and was so gentle and skillful that Apollo was amazed. The god resumed his own form and embraced the lad and told him he was pleased with his progress. He sent him to see his aunt Athena, who, he said, knew certain secrets of mortality. She too approved of the young man and gave him two vials of Gorgon blood. One vial could raise the dead. The other was the deadliest poison ever known. "No, aunt," he said, "I need only the first vial. You keep the other." Some say that it was by his own skill that he restored life to the dead, and that Athena was simply trying to take some of the credit for herself. Be that as it may, he did snatch several patients from the very gates of Tartarus, and Hades was enraged. He complained to his brother Zeus that Asclepius was robbing him. Zeus stood on Olympus, hurled a thunderbolt, and killed the young physician together with the patient he was tending. When Apollo heard about this, he went into one of his wild, heedless rages, stormed to Olympus, battered in the doors of Hephaestus's smithy, and there slew all of the Cyclopes, who had forged the thunderbolt which had killed his son. When Zeus heard this, he banished Apollo to Tartarus forever. But Mother Leto came and pleaded with him, reminding him of their old love. She spoke so beautifully that Zeus relented, withdrew the edict of Apollo's banishment, and even agreed to bring Asclepius back to life. But he suggested that Asclepius be more tactful about his cures and avoid offending the gods. When Aphrodite heard this story, she was bitten by envy. She considered herself a favorite of Zeus, but he had never done so much for her. Her heart was bitter against Apollo, and she wanted to do him a mischief. She called her son Eros, the infant archer, whose sweetly poisoned arrows infect man and woman with the most dangerous fever. She told him what she wanted. Eros had two kinds of arrows, one tipped with gold and tailed with white dove feathers. These were for love. The others, made of lead, with brown owl feathers, were the arrows of indifference. He took up his bow and stalked his game. Apollo, he knew, was hunting, so he made Apollo's path cross that of Daphne, a mountain nymph, daughter of the river god Peneus. Then, fluttering above them, invisible, he shot Apollo with the dart of love, and Daphne with the arrow of indifference. When the golden god came running down the slope toward the nymph, he saw her start up and run away. He could not understand it. She fled, the god pursued. She was a very swift runner, but great footsteps pounded behind her, and she felt the heat of his breath on her shoulders. She ran toward the river and cried, "O father, save me! Save me!" Her father heard. Apollo, reaching for her, found himself hugging a tree. The rough bark scratched his face. He said, "But why? Why do you hate me so?" The wind blew through the leaves, and they whispered, "I don't know. I don't know." But then the tree took pity on the grieving god, and gave him a gift, a wreath of her leaves, laurel leaves that would never wither, to crown heroes and poets and young men who win games. And still today, when questioned by losers, laurel trees whisper, "I don't know. I don't know." Hermes. Young gods were often precocious, but no one so much as Hermes, who 5 minutes after his birth sneaked out of his crib and went searching for adventure. He toddled swiftly down the slope of Mount Selene until he came to a meadow where he saw a herd of beautiful white cows grazing. He saw no cowherd and decided to steal them. A tree full of crows began to seethe and whistle. They belonged to Apollo, to Apollo, Apollo. But he paid them no heed. He plaited grass into shoes for the cows, and fitted them over the hooves and drove them away. When Apollo returned, he was furious to see his cows gone, and even more furious when he searched for tracks and found none, only odd sweeping marks on the ground. The crows chattered, "A baby stole them! Your brother! Your brother!" But this made no sense to Apollo. Besides, he did not trust crows. He did not know where to begin looking. He searched far and wide, but could find no clue. Then one morning he passed a cave he had passed 100 times before. But this time he heard strange, beautiful sounds coming out of it. Sounds unlike anything he had ever heard before. And he looked inside. There, drowsing by the fire, was a tall, lovely Titaness named Maia, whom he had seen before in the garden on Olympus. Sitting in her lap was a little baby boy doing something to a large tortoise shell from which the strange sounds seemed to be coming. "Good day, cousin," said Apollo. "Are you to be congratulated on a new son?" "Hail, bright Phoebus," said Maia. "May I have the honor of presenting your half-brother, young Hermes?" "Half-brother, eh? Well, that's an honor without being a distinction. What's that he's playing with?"
"He makes his own toys," said Maia proudly.
"He's so clever, you can't imagine. He made this out of an old shell that he strung with cowgut, and from it he draws the most ravishing sounds.
Listen!"
"Cowgut! May I ask what cow he persuaded to contribute her vital cords for his pastime?"
"I do not understand your question, cousin."
"Understand this, cousin. I have had a herd of cows stolen recently. The crows told me they had been taken by some baby, my brother, but I didn't believe them. I seem to owe them an apology."
"What?" cried Maia. "Are you accusing the innocent babe of being a cattle thief? For shame!"
"Mother, if you don't mind," said a clear little voice, "perhaps you'd better let me handle this." The baby stood on his mother's knee and bowed to Apollo. "I did take your cows, brother, but I didn't know they were yours. How could I have?" "And they are quite safe, except for one. Wishing to begin my life with an act of piety, I sacrificed her to the 12 gods.
12 gods, said Apollo haughtily. "I am acquainted with but 11.
"Yes, sir," said Hermes, "but I have the honor to be the 12th. Above all things, I wish your good will, fair brother. So, in return for this cow, allow me to make you a present, this instrument. I call it a lyre. I'll be glad to teach you to play."
Apollo was enchanted with the trade. He stayed in the cave all that afternoon practicing his scales. As he was strumming his new toy, he noticed Hermes cutting reeds, which the child swiftly tied together, notched in a certain way, then put to his lips, and began to make other sounds, even more beautiful than the lyre could produce.
"What's that?" cried Apollo. "What do you call that? I want that too."
"I don't need any more cows," said Hermes.
"I must have it. What else of mine do you wish?"
"Your golden staff."
"But this is my herdsman's staff. Do you not know that I am the god of herdsmen, and that this is the rod of authority?"
"A minor office," said Hermes, "unworthy of the Lord of the Sun. Perhaps you would allow me to take over the chore. Give me your golden staff, and I will give you these pipes."
"Agreed, agreed."
"But since pipes and lyre together will make you god of music, I must have something to boot. Teach me augury."
"You drive a hard bargain for a nursling," said Apollo. "I think you belong on Olympus, brother. This cave will not long offer scope for your talents."
"Oh, yes, take me there," cried Hermes. "I am eager to meet Father Zeus."
So Apollo took Hermes to Olympus and introduced him to his father. Zeus was intrigued by the wit and impudence of the child. He hid him away from Hera and spent hours conversing with him.
"You say you wish to enter the Pantheon," said Zeus. "But really, all the realms and powers seem to have been parceled out."
"Father, I am of modest nature," said Hermes. "I require no vast dignities, only a chance to be useful, to serve you, and to dwell in your benign and potent presence. Let me be your herald. Let me carry your tidings. You will find me quick and resourceful, and what I can't remember, I will make up. And I guarantee your subjects will get the message."
"Ha ha ha! Very well," said Zeus. "I will give you a trial."
So Hermes became the messenger god and accomplished his duties with such swiftness, ingenuity, and cheerfulness that he became a favorite of his father, who soon rewarded him with other posts. Hermes became patron of liars and thieves and gamblers, god of commerce, framer of treaties, and guardian of travelers. Hades became his client too, and called upon him to usher the newly dead from Earth to Tartarus. He kept a workshop on Olympus, and there invented the alphabet, astronomy, and the scales, also playing cards and card games. He carried Apollo's golden staff, decorated with white ribbons, wore a pot-shaped hat, and winged sandals which carried him through the air more swiftly than any bird could fly. It was he who gave Zeus the idea of disguising himself and mingling with mortals when bored with Olympus. He joined his father in this, and they had many adventures together, which will be told in their place. Hephaestus. No one celebrated the birth of Hephaestus. His mother Hera had awaited him with great eagerness, hoping for a child so beautiful, so gifted, that it would make Zeus forget his heroic swarm of children from lesser consorts. But when the baby was born, she was appalled to see that he was shriveled and ugly, with an irritating bleating wail. She did not wait for Zeus to see him, but snatched the infant up and hurled him off Olympus. For a night and a day he fell, and hit the ground at the edge of the sea with such force that both of his legs were broken. He lay there on the beach, mewing piteously, unable to crawl, racked with pain, but unable to die, because he was immortal. Finally the tide came up,
A huge wave curled him under its arm and carried him off to sea. And there he sank like a stone, and was caught by the playful Thetis, a naiad who thought he was a tadpole. When Thetis understood it was a baby she had caught, she made a pet of him and kept him in her grotto. She was amazed at the way the crippled child worked shells and bright pebbles into jewelry. One day she appeared at a great festival of the gods, wearing a necklace he had made. Hera noticed the ornament and praised it, and asked her how she had come by it. Thetis told her of the strange, twisted child whom someone had dropped into the ocean, and who lived now in her cave making wonderful jewels. Hera divined that it was her own son and demanded him back. Hephaestus returned to Olympus. There Hera presented him with a broken mountain nearby, where he could set up forges and bellows. She gave him the brawny Cyclopes to be his helpers, and promised him Aphrodite as a bride, if he would labor in the mountain and make her fine things. Hephaestus agreed, because he loved her, and excused her cruelty to him. "I know that I am ugly, mother," he said, "but the fates would have it so, and I will make you gems so beautiful for your tapering arms and white throat and black hair that you will forget my ugliness sometimes and rejoice that you have taken me back from the sea." He became the smith god, the great artificer, lord of mechanics, and the mountain always smoked and rumbled with his toil. And he has always been very ugly and very useful. Aphrodite was the goddess of love and beauty. So there are more stories told about her than anyone else, god or mortal. Being what she is, she enters other stories, and such is the power of her magic girdle that he who even speaks her name falls under her spell and seems to glimpse her white shoulders and catch the perfume of her golden hair. And he loses his wits and begins to babble and tells the same story in many ways. But all the tales agree that she is the goddess of desire and, unlike other Olympians, is never distracted from her duties. Her work is her pleasure, her profession, her hobby. She thinks of nothing but love, and nobody expects more of her. She was born out of the primal murder. When Cronus butchered his father Uranus with the scythe his mother had given him, he flung the dismembered body off Olympus into the sea, where it floated, spouting blood and seed which drifted, whitening in the sun. From the foam rose a tall, beautiful maiden, naked and dripping. Waves attended her. Poseidon's white horses brought her to the island of Cythera. Wherever she stepped, the sand turned to grass and flowers bloomed. Then she went to Cyprus. Hillsides burst into flowers, and the air was full of birds. Zeus brought her to Olympus. She was still dripping from the sea. She wore nothing but the bright tunic of her hair, which fell to mid-thigh and was yellow as daffodils. She looked about the great throne room where the gods were assembled to meet her, arched her throat, and laughed with joy. Hera was watching Zeus narrowly. "You must marry her off," she whispered, "at once, without delay." "Yes," said Zeus, "some sort of marriage would seem to be indicated." And he said, "Brothers, sons, cousins, Aphrodite is to be married. She will choose her own husband. So make your suit." The gods closed around her, shouting promises, pressing their claims. Earth-shaking Poseidon swung his mighty trident to clear a space about himself. "I claim you for the sea," he said. "You are sea-born, foam-born, and belong to me. I offer you grottos, riddles, gems, fair surfaces, dark surroundings. I offer you variety, drowned sailors, typhoons, sunsets. I offer you secrets. I offer you riches that the earth does not know. power more subtle, more fluid than the dull fixed land. Come with me. Be queen of the sea. He slammed his trident on the floor, and a huge green tidal wave swelled out of the sea, high, high as Olympus, curling its mighty green tongue as if to lick up the mountain, and poised there, quivering, not breaking, as the gods gaped. Then Poseidon raised his trident, and the mighty wave subsided like a ripple. He bowed to Aphrodite. She smiled at him, but said nothing. Then the gods spoke in turn, offering her great gifts. Apollo offered her a throne, and a crown made of hottest sun gold, a golden chariot drawn by white swans, and the muses for her handmaids. Hermes offered to make her queen of the crossways, where all must come, where she would hear every story, see every traveler, know each deed, a rich pageant of adventure and gossip, so that she would never grow bored. She smiled at Apollo and Hermes and made no answer. Then Hera, scowling, reached her long white arm and dragged Hephaestus, the lame smith god, from where he had been hiding behind the others, ashamed to be seen. And she hissed into his ear, "Speak, fool! Say exactly what I told you to say!" He limped forward with great embarrassment, and stood before the radiant goddess, eyes cast down, not daring to look at her. He said, "I would make a good husband for a girl like you. I work late." Aphrodite smiled. She said nothing, but put her finger under the chin of the grimy little smith, raised his face, leaned down, and kissed him on the lips. That night they were married. And at the wedding party she finally spoke, whispering to each of her suitors, telling each one when he might come with his gift. Nature Myths. Prometheus. Prometheus was a young Titan, no great admirer of Zeus. Although he knew the great lord of the sky hated explicit questions, he did not hesitate to beard him when there was something he wanted to know. One morning he came to Zeus and said, "O Thunderer, I do not understand your design. You have caused the race of man to appear on earth, but you keep him in ignorance and darkness."
"Perhaps you had better leave the race of man to me," said Zeus. "What you call ignorance is innocence. What you call darkness is the shadow of my decree. Man is happy now, and he is so framed that he will remain happy unless someone persuades him that he is unhappy. Let us not speak of this again."
But Prometheus said, "Look at him! Look below! He crouches in caves. He is at the mercy of beast and weather. He eats his meat raw. If you mean something by this, enlighten me with your wisdom. Tell me why you refuse to give man the gift of fire."
Zeus answered, "Do you not know, Prometheus, that every gift brings a penalty? This is the way the fates weave destiny, by which gods also must abide. Man does not have fire, true, nor the crafts which fire teaches. On the other hand, he does not know disease, warfare, old age, or that inward pest called worry. He is happy, I say, happy without fire, and so he shall remain."
"Happy as beasts are happy," said Prometheus. "Of what use to make a separate race called man and endow him with little fur, some wit, and a curious charm of unpredictability? If he must live like this, why separate him from the beasts at all?"
"He has another quality," said Zeus, "the capacity for worship, an aptitude for admiring our power, being puzzled by our riddles and amazed by our caprice. That is why he was made."
"Would not fire and the graces he can put on with fire make him more interesting?"
"More interesting, perhaps, but infinitely more dangerous,"
For there is this in man too, a vaunting pride that needs little sustenance to make it swell to giant size. Improve his lot, and he will forget that which makes him pleasing, his sense of worship, his humility. He will grow big and poisoned with pride and fancy himself a god, and before we know it we shall see him storming Olympus. Enough, Prometheus! I have been patient with you, but do not try me too far. Go now, and trouble me no more with your speculations. Prometheus was not satisfied. All that night he lay awake making plans. Then he left his couch at dawn, and standing tiptoe on Olympus, stretched his arm to the eastern horizon, where the first faint flames of the sun were flickering. In his hand he held a reed filled with a dry fiber. He thrust it into the sunrise until a spark smoldered. Then he put the reed in his tunic and came down from the mountain. At first men were frightened by the gift. It was so hot, so quick. It bit sharply when you touched it, and for pure spite made the shadows dance. They thanked Prometheus and asked him to take it away. But he took the haunch of a newly killed deer and held it over the fire. And when the meat began to sear and sputter, filling the cave with its rich smells, the people felt themselves melting with hunger and flung themselves on the meat and devoured it greedily, burning their tongues. "This that I have brought you is called fire," Prometheus said. "It is an ill-natured spirit, a little brother of the sun. But if you handle it carefully, it can change your whole life. It is very greedy. You must feed it twigs, but only until it becomes a proper size. Then you must stop, or it will eat everything in sight, and you too. If it escapes, use this magic, water. It fears the water spirit, and if you touch it with water, it will fly away until you need it again." He left the fire burning in the first cave, with children staring at it wide-eyed, and then went to every cave in the land. Then one day Zeus looked down from the mountain and was amazed. Everything had changed. Man had come out of his cave. Zeus saw woodsmen's huts, farmhouses, villages, walled towns, even a castle or two. He saw men cooking their food, carrying torches to light their way at night. He saw forges blazing, men beating out plows, keels, swords, spears. They were making ships and raising white wings of sails and daring to use the fury of the winds for their journeys. They were wearing helmets, riding out in chariots to do battle, like the gods themselves. Zeus was full of rage. He seized his largest thunderbolt. "So they want fire," he said to himself. "I'll give them fire, more than they can use. I'll turn their miserable little ball of earth into a cinder." But then another thought came to him, and he lowered his arm. "No," he said to himself, "I shall have vengeance, and entertainment, too. Let them destroy themselves with their new skills. This will make a long, twisted game interesting to watch. I'll attend to them later. My first business is with Prometheus." He called his giant guards and had them seize Prometheus, drag him off to the Caucasus, and there bind him to a mountain peak with great chains, specially forged by Hephaestus. Chains which even a titan in agony could not break. And when the friend of man was bound to the mountain, Zeus sent two vultures to hover about him forever, tearing at his belly and eating his liver. Men knew a terrible thing was happening on the mountain, but they did not know what. But the wind shrieked like a giant in torment, and sometimes like fierce birds. Many centuries he lay there, until another hero was born brave enough to defy the gods. He climbed to the peak in the Caucasus and struck the shackles from Prometheus
and killed the vultures. His name was Heracles.
Pandora. After Zeus had condemned Prometheus for giving fire to man, he began to plan how to punish man for accepting it. Finally, he hit upon a scheme. He ordered Hephaestus to mold a girl out of clay and to have Aphrodite pose for it to make sure it was beautiful. He breathed life into the clay figure. The clay turned to flesh, and she lay sleeping, all new. Then he summoned the gods and asked them each to give her a gift. Apollo taught her to sing and play the lyre. Athena taught her to spin, Demeter to tend a garden. Aphrodite taught her how to look at a man without moving her eyes, and how to dance without moving her legs. Poseidon gave her a pearl necklace, and promised she would never drown. And finally, Hermes gave her a beautiful golden box, which, he told her, she must never, never open. And then Hera gave her curiosity. Hermes took her by the hand and led her down the slope of Olympus. He led her to Epimetheus, brother of Prometheus, and said, "Father Zeus grieves at the disgrace which has fallen upon your family, and to show you that he holds you blameless in your brother's offense, he makes you this gift, this girl, fairest in all the world. She is to be your wife. Her name is Pandora, the All-Gifted." So Epimetheus and Pandora were married. Pandora spun and baked, and tended her garden, and played the lyre and danced for her husband, and thought herself the happiest young bride in all the world. Only one thing bothered her: the golden box. First she kept it on the table and polished it every day, so that all might admire it. But the sunlight lanced through the window, and the box sparkled and seemed to be winking at her. She found herself thinking, "Hermes must have been teasing. He's always making jokes, everyone knows that. Yes, he was teasing, telling me never to open his gift. For if it is so beautiful outside, what must it be inside? Why, he has hidden a surprise for me there. Gems, more lovely than have ever been seen, no doubt. If the box is so rich, the gift inside must be even more splendid, for that is the way of gifts. Perhaps Hermes is waiting for me to open the box and see what is inside, and be delighted and thank him. Perhaps he thinks me ungrateful." But even as she was telling herself this, she knew it was not so, that the box must not be opened, that she must keep her promise. Finally, she took the box from the table and hid it in a dusty little storeroom. But it seemed to be burning there in the shadows. Its heat seemed to scorch her thoughts wherever she went. She kept passing that room and stepping into it, making excuses to dawdle there. Sometimes she took the box from its hiding place and stroked it, then quickly shoved it out of sight and rushed out of the room. She took it then, locked it in a heavy oaken chest, put great shackles on the chest, and dug a hole in her garden. She put the chest in, covered it over, and rolled a boulder on top of it. When Epimetheus came home that night, her hair was wild and her hands were bloody, her tunic torn and stained, but all she would tell him was that she had been working in the garden. That night the moonlight blazed into the room. She could not sleep. The light pressed her eyes open. She sat up in bed and looked around. All the room was swimming in moonlight. Everything was different. There were deep shadows and swaths of silver, all mixed, all moving. She arose quietly and tiptoed from the room. She went out into the garden. The flowers were blowing. The trees were swaying. The whole world was a dance in the magic white fire of that moonlight.
She walked to the rock and pushed it. It rolled away as lightly as a pebble, and she felt herself full of wild strength. She took a shovel and dug down to the chest. She unshackled it and drew out the golden box. It was cold. Cold. Coldness burned her hand to the bone. She trembled. What was inside that box seemed to her now the very secret of life, which she must look upon or die. She took the little golden key from her tunic, fitted it into the keyhole, and gently opened the lid. There was a swarming, a hot throbbing, a wild, meaty rustling, and a foul smell. Out of the box, as she held it up in the moonlight, swarmed small, scaly, lizard-like creatures with bat wings and burning red eyes. They flew out of the box, circled her head once, clapping their wings and screaming thin little jeering screams, and then flew off into the night, hissing and cackling. Then, half-fainting, sinking to her knees, Pandora, with her last bit of strength, clutched the box and slammed down the lid, catching the last little monster just as it was wriggling free. It shrieked and spat and clawed her hand, but she thrust it back into the box and locked it in. Then she dropped the box and fainted away. What were those deathly creatures that flew out of the golden box? They were the ills that beset mankind, the spites, disease in its thousand shapes, old age, famine, insanity, and all their foul kin. After they flew out of the box, they scattered, flew into every home and swung from the rafters, waiting. And when their time comes, they fly and sting, and bring pain and sorrow and death. At that, things could have been much worse, for the creature that Pandora shut into the box was the most dangerous of all. It was foreboding, the final spite. If it had flown free, everyone in the world would have been told exactly what misfortune was to happen every day of his life. No hope would have been possible, and so there would have been an end to man. For though he can bear endless trouble, he cannot live with no hope at all. Phaethon. Long ago, when the world was very new, two boys were racing along the edge of a cliff that hung over a deep blue sea. They were the same size. One boy had black hair, the other had yellow hair. The race was very close. Then the yellow-haired one spurted ahead and won the race. The loser was very angry. "You think you're pretty good," he said, "but you're not so much. My father is Zeus." "My father is Apollo," said the yellow-haired boy, whose name was Phaethon. "My father is the chief god, king of the mountain, lord of the sky." "My father is lord of the sun." "My father is called the thunderer. When he is angry, the sky grows black and the sun hides. His spear is a lightning bolt, and that's what he kills people with. He hurls it 1,000 miles, and it never misses. Without my father, there would be no day. It would always be night. Each morning he hitches up his horses and drives the golden chariot of the sun across the sky. And that is daytime. Then he dives into the ocean stream and boards a golden ferry boat and sails back to his eastern palace. That time is called night. "Sometimes I visit my father," said Epaphus, the other boy. "I sit on Olympus with him, and he teaches me things and gives me presents." "Know what he gave me last time? A little thunderbolt just like his, and he taught me how to throw it. I killed 3 vultures, scared a fishing boat, started a forest fire. Next time I go, I'll throw it at more things. Do you visit your father?" Phaethon never had, but he could not bear to tell Epaphus. "Certainly," he said, "very often.
I go to the Eastern Palace, and he teaches me things, too. What kind of things? Has he taught you to drive the horses of the sun?
Oh, yes. He taught me to handle their reins, and how to make them go, and how to make them stop. And they're huge horses, tall as this mountain. They breathe fire.
I think you're making it all up, said Epaphus. I can tell. I don't even believe there is a sun chariot. There's the sun, look at it. It's not a chariot.
Oh, what you see is just one of the wheels, said Phaethon. There's another wheel on the other side. The body of the chariot is slung between them. That is where the driver stands and whips his horses. You cannot see it because your eyes are too small, and the glare is too bright.
Well, said Epaphus, maybe it is a chariot, but I still don't believe your father lets you drive it. In fact, I don't believe you've been to the Palace of the Sun. I doubt that Apollo would know you if he saw you. Maybe he isn't even your father. People like to say they're descended from the gods, of course, but how many of us are there, really?
I'll prove it to you, cried Phaethon, stamping his foot. I'll go to the Palace of the Sun right now and hold my father to his promise. I'll show you.
What promise?
He said I was getting to be so good a charioteer that next time he would let me drive the sun chariot alone. All by myself, from dawn to night, right across the sky. And this time is next time.
Poof! Words are cheap, said Epaphus.
How will I know it's you driving the sun? I won't be able to see you from down here.
You'll know me, said Phaethon. When I pass the village, I will come down close and drive in circles around your roof. You'll see me, all right. Farewell.
Are you starting now?
Now, at once. Just watch the sky tomorrow, son of Zeus.
And he went off.
He was so stung by the words of his friend and the boasting and lying he had been forced to do that he traveled night and day, not stopping for food or rest, guiding himself by the morning star and the evening star, heading always east. Nor did he know the way, for indeed he had never once seen his father Apollo. He knew him only through his mother's stories, but he did know that the palace must lie in the east, because that is where he saw the sun start each morning. He walked on and on until finally he lost his way completely and, weakened by hunger and exhaustion, fell swooning in a great meadow by the edge of a wood. Now, while Phaethon was making his journey, Apollo sat in his great throne room on a huge throne made of gold and rubies. This was the quiet hour before dawn, when night left its last coolness upon the earth. And it was then, at this hour, that Apollo sat on his throne, wearing a purple cloak embroidered with the golden signs of the zodiac. On his head was a crown given him by the dawn goddess, made of silver and pearls. A bird flew in the window and perched on his shoulder, and spoke to him. This bird had sky-blue feathers, golden beak, golden claws, and golden eyes. It was one of Apollo's sun-hawks. It was this bird's job to fly here and there, gathering gossip. Sometimes she was called the spy-bird.
Now, she said, Apollo, I have seen your son.
Which son?
Phaethon. He's coming to see you, but he has lost his way and lies exhausted at the edge of the wood. The wolves will surely eat him. Do you care?
I will have to see him before I know whether I care. You had better get back to him before the wolves do. Bring him here in comfort. Round up some of your companions, and bring him here as befits the son of a god. The sun hawk seized the softly glowing rug at the foot of the throne, and flew away with it. She summoned three of her companions, and they each took a corner of the rug. They flew over a desert and a mountain and a wood, and came to the field where Phaethon lay.
They flew down among the howling of wolves, among burning eyes set in a circle about the unconscious boy. They pushed him onto the rug, and each took a corner in her beak and flew away. Phaethon felt himself being lifted into the air. The cold wind of his going revived him, and he sat up. People below saw a boy sitting with folded arms on a carpet rushing through the cold, bright moonlight far above their heads. It was too dark, though, to see the birds, and that is why we hear tales of flying carpets even to this day. Phaethon was not particularly surprised to find himself in the air. The last thing he remembered was lying down on the grass. Now he knew he was dreaming. A good dream. Floating and flying, his favorite kind. And when he saw the great cloud castle on top of the mountain, all made of snow, rose in the early light, he was more sure than ever that he was dreaming. He saw sentries in flashing golden armor, carrying golden spears. In the courtyard he saw enormous woolly dogs with fleece like cloud drift, guarding the gate. These were Apollo's great sunhounds. Over the wall flew the carpet, over the courtyard, through the tall portals, and it wasn't until the sunhawks gently let down the carpet in front of the throne that he began to think that this dream might be very real. He raised his eyes shyly and saw a tall figure sitting on the throne. Taller than any man, and appallingly beautiful to the boy. With his golden hair and stormy blue eyes and strong laughing face, Phaethon fell on his knees. "Father," he cried, "I am Phaethon, your son." "Rise, Phaethon. Let me look at you." He stood up, his legs trembling. "Yes, you may well be my son. I seem to see a resemblance. Which one did you say?" "Phaethon." "Oh, Clymenes' boy. I remember your mother well. How is she?"
"In health, sire."
"And did I not leave some daughters with her as well? Yellow-haired girls, quite pretty."
"My sisters, sire. The Heliads."
"Yes, of course. Must get over that way and visit them all one of these seasons. And you, lad, what brings you to me? Do you not know that it is courteous to await an invitation before visiting a god, even if he is in the family?"
"I know, father, but I had no choice. I was taunted by a son of Zeus, Epaphus, and I would have flung him over the cliff and myself after him if I had not resolved to make my lies come true."
"Well, you're my son, all right. Proud, rash, accepting no affront, refusing no adventure. I know the breed. Speak up, then. What is it you wish? I will do anything in my power to help you."
"Anything, father?"
"Anything I can. I swear by the river Styx, an oath sacred to the gods."
"I wish to drive the sun across the sky, all by myself, from dawn till night."
Apollo's roar of anger shattered every crystal goblet in the great castle. "Impossible," he cried. "No one drives those horses but me. They are tall as mountains. Their breath is fire. They are stronger than the tides, stronger than the wind. It is all that I can do to hold them in check. How can your puny grip restrain them? They will race away with the chariot, scorching the poor earth to a cinder."
"You promised, father."
"Yes, I promised, foolish lad. And that promise is a death warrant. A poor charred cinder floating in space. Well, that is what the oracle predicted for the earth, but I did not know it would be so soon. So soon."
"It is almost dawn, father. Should we not saddle the horses?"
"Will you not withdraw your request? Allow me to preserve my honor without destroying the earth. Ask me anything else, and I will grant it. Do not ask me this.
I have asked, sire, and you have promised. And the hour for dawn comes, and the horses are unharnessed. The sun will rise late today, confusing the wise.
They will be more than confused when this day is done, said Apollo. Come. Apollo took Phaethon to the stable of the sun, and there the boy saw the giant fire-white horses being harnessed to the golden chariot. Huge they were, fire-white with golden manes and golden hooves and hot yellow eyes. When they neighed, the trumpet call of it rolled across the sky, and their breath was flame. They were being harnessed by a titan, a cousin of the gods, tall as a tree, dressed in asbestos armor with helmet of tinted crystal against the glare. The sun chariot was an open shell of gold. Each wheel was the flat, round disk of the sun as it is seen in the sky. And Phaethon looked very tiny as he stood in the chariot. The reins were thick as bridge cables, much too large for him to hold, so Apollo tied them around his waist. Then Apollo stood at the head of the team, gentling the horses, speaking softly to them, calling them by name. Pyroius, Eos, Aethon, Phlegon. Good lads, good horses. Go easy today, my swift ones. Go at a slow trot and do not leave the path. You have a new driver today. The great horses dropped their heads to his shoulder and whinnied softly, for they loved him. Phaethon saw the flame of their breath play about his head, saw Apollo's face shining out of the flame. But he was not harmed, for he was a god, and could not be hurt by physical things. He came to Phaethon and said, "Listen to me, son. You are about to start a terrible journey. Now, by the obedience you owe me as a son, by the faith you owe a god, by my oath that cannot be broken, and your pride that will not bend, I put this rule upon you. Keep the middle way. Too high, and the earth will freeze. Too low, and it will burn. Keep the middle way. Give the horses their heads. They know the path. The blue middle course of day. Drive them not too high nor too low, but above all, do not stop, or you will fire the air about you where you stand, charring the earth and blistering the sky. Do you heed me?"
"I do, I do," cried Phaethon. "Stand away, sire. The dawn grows old and day must begin. Go, horses, go!"
And Apollo stood watching as the horses of the sun went into a swinging trot, pulling behind them the golden chariot, climbing the first eastern steep of the sky. At first, things went well. The great steeds trotted easily along their path across the high blue meadow of the sky. And Phaethon thought to himself, "I can't understand why my father was making such a fuss. This is easy. For me, anyway. Perhaps I'm a natural-born coachman, though." He looked over the edge of the chariot. He saw tiny houses down below and specks of trees, and the dark blue puddle of the sea. The coach was trundling across the sky. The great sun wheels were turning, casting light, warming and brightening the earth, chasing all the shadows of night.
"Just imagine," Phaethon thought, "how many people now are looking up at the sky, praising the sun, hoping the weather stays fair. How many people are watching me, me, me?"
Then he thought, "But I'm too small to see. They can't even see the coach or the horses, only the great wheel. We are too far and the light is too bright. For all they know, it is Apollo making his usual run. How can they know it's me, me, me?
How will my mother know, and my sisters?
They would be so proud.
And Apophis, above all. Apophis, how will he know?
I'll come home tomorrow after this glorious journey and tell him what I did, and he will laugh at me and tell me I'm lying, as he did before. And how shall I prove it to him? No, this must not be. I must show him that it is I driving the chariot of the sun, I alone.
Apollo said not to come too close to Earth, but how will he know?
And I won't stay too long. Just dip down toward our own village and circle his roof 3 times, which is the signal we agreed upon. After he recognizes me, I'll whip up the horses and resume the path of the day. He jerked on the reins, pulled the horses' heads down. They whinnied angrily and tossed their heads. He jerked the reins again.
Down, he cried. Down, down!
The horses plunged through the bright air, golden hooves twinkling, golden manes flying, dragging the great glittering chariot after them in a long flaming swoop. When they reached his village, he was horrified to see the roofs bursting into fire. The trees burned. People rushed about, screaming. Their loose clothing caught fire, and they burned like torches as they ran. Was it his village? He could not tell because of the smoke. Had he destroyed his own home, burned his mother and his sisters? He threw himself backward in the chariot, pulling at the reins with all his might, shouting, "Up! Up!" And the horses, made furious by the smoke, reared on their hind legs in the air, then leaped upward, galloping through the smoke, pulling the chariot up, up. Swiftly the earth fell away beneath them. The village was just a smudge of smoke. Again he saw the pencil stroke of mountains, the ink blot of seas. "Whoa!" he cried. "Turn now, forward on your path!" But he could no longer handle them. They were galloping, not trotting. They had taken the bit in their teeth. They did not turn toward the path of the day across the meadow of the sky, but galloped up, up. And the people on earth saw the sun shooting away until it was no larger than a star. Darkness came, and cold. The earth froze hard. Rivers froze and oceans. Boats were caught fast in the ice in every sea. It snowed in the jungle. Marble buildings cracked. It was impossible for anyone to speak. Breath froze on the speaker's lips. And in village and city, in the field and in the wood, people died of the cold. And the bodies piled up where they fell, like firewood. Still Phaethon could not hold his horses. And still they galloped upward, dragging light and warmth away from the earth. Finally they went so high that the air was too thin to breathe. Phaethon saw the flame of their breath, which had been red and yellow, burn blue in the thin air. He himself was gasping for breath. He felt the marrow of his bones freezing. Now the horses, wild with change, maddened by the feeble hand on the reins, swung around and dived toward earth again. Now all the ice melted, making great floods. Villages were swept away by a solid wall of water. Trees were uprooted, and whole forests were torn away. The fields were covered by water. Lower swooped the horses, and lower yet. Now the water began to steam. Great billowing clouds of steam as the water boiled. Dead fish floated on the surface. Naiads moaned in dry riverbeds. Phaethon could not see. The steam was too thick. He had unbound the reins from his waist, or they would have cut him in two. He had no control over the horses at all. They galloped upward again, out of the steam, taking at last the middle road, but racing wildly, using all their tremendous speed. circling the earth in a matter of minutes, smashing across the sky from horizon to horizon, making the day flash on and off like a child playing with a lamp. And the people who were left alive were bewildered by the light and darkness, following each other so swiftly. Up high on Olympus, the gods in their cool garden heard a clamor of grief from below. Zeus looked upon Earth. He saw the runaway horses of the sun and the hurtling chariot. He saw the dead and the dying, the burning forests, the floods, the weird frost. Then he looked again at the chariot and saw that it was not Apollo driving, but someone he